Despite the weakness of such a beginning, a physio year was sufficient to make Harlan known throughout eternity as Twistle's technician, and with more than a trace of ill humor as the Wonder Boy and the Never Wrong. His contact with Cooper became almost comfortable. They never grew completely friendly. If Cooper could have brought himself to make advances, Harlan might not have known how to respond. Nevertheless, they worked well together, and Cooper's interest in primitive history grew to the point where it nearly rivaled Harlan's. One day, Harlan said to Cooper, "Look, Cooper, would you mind coming in tomorrow instead? I've got to get up to the 3000 sometime this week to check on an observation, and the man I want to see is free this afternoon." Cooper's eyes lit up, hungrily. "Why can't I come?"
"Do you want to?"
"Sure. I've never been in a kettle, except when they brought me here from the 78th, and I didn't know what was happening at the time."
Harlan was accustomed to using the kettle in Shaft C, which was, by unwritten custom, reserved for technicians along its entire, immeasurable length through the centuries. Cooper showed no embarrassment at being led there. He stepped into the kettle without hesitation and took his seat on the curved molding that completely circled it. When Harlan, however, had activated the field and kicked the kettle into upwind motion, Cooper's face screwed into an almost comic expression of surprise.
"I don't feel a thing," he said. "Is anything wrong?"
"Nothing's wrong. You're not feeling anything because you're not really moving. You're being kicked along the temporal extension of the kettle. In fact," Harlan said, growing didactic, "at the moment you and I aren't matter, really, in spite of appearances. 100 men could be using this same kettle, moving, if you can call it that, at various velocities in either time direction, passing through one another and so on. The laws of the ordinary universe just don't apply to the kettle shafts."
Cooper's mouth quirked a bit, and Harlan thought uneasily, "The kid's taking temporal engineering and knows more about this than I do. Why don't I shut up and stop making a fool of myself?" He retreated into silence and stared somberly at Cooper. The younger man's mustache had been full-grown for months. It drooped, framing his mouth in what Eternals called Melanson hairline, because the only photograph known to be authentic of the temporal field inventor, and that a poor one and out of focus, showed him with just such a mustache. For that reason, it maintained a certain popularity among Eternals, even though it did few of them justice. Cooper's eyes were fixed on the shifting numbers that marked the passing of the centuries with respect to themselves. He said, "How far upwind does the kettle shaft go?"
"Haven't they taught you that?"
"They've hardly mentioned the kettles."
Harlan shrugged.
"There's no end to eternity. The shaft goes on forever."
"How far upwind have you gone?"
"This will be the uppest. Dr. Twistle has been up to the 50,000s.
"Great time," whispered Cooper.
"Well, that's still nothing. Some Eternals have been up past the 150,000th century.
"What's that like?"
"Like nothing at all," said Harlan morosely. "Lots of life, but none of it human. Man is gone."
"Dead? Wiped out?"
"I don't know that anyone exactly knows."
"Can't something be done to change that?"
"Well, from the 70,000s on," began Harlan, then ended abruptly.
"Oh, to time with it.
Change the subject."
If there was one subject about which Eternals were almost superstitious, it was the hidden centuries, the time between the 70,000th and the 150,000th. It was a subject that was rarely mentioned. It was only Harlan's close association with Twistle that accounted for his own small knowledge of the era. What it amounted to was that Eternals couldn't pass into time in all those thousands of centuries. The doors between eternity and time were impenetrable. Why? No one knew. Harlan imagined, from some casual remarks of Twistle's, that attempts had been made to change the reality in the centuries just downwind from the 70,000th, but without adequate observation beyond the 70,000th, not much could be done. Twistle had laughed a bit one time and said,
We'll get through some day. Meanwhile, 70,000 centuries is quite enough to take care of.
It did not sound wholly convincing.
What happens to eternity after the 150,000th? Asked Cooper.
Harlan sighed. The subject, apparently, was not to be changed.
Nothing, he said. The sections are there, but there are no eternals in it, anywhere after the 70,000th. The sections keep on going for millions of centuries till all life is gone, and past that, too. Till the sun becomes a nova, and past that, too. There isn't any end to eternity. That's why it's called eternity.
The sun does become a nova, then?
It certainly does. Eternity couldn't exist if that weren't so. Nova Sol is our power supply. Listen, do you know how much power is required to set up a temporal field? Melanson's first field was 2 seconds from extreme downwind to extreme upwind, and big enough to hold not more than a matchhead, and that took a nuclear power plant's complete output for one day. It took nearly 100 years to set up a hair-thin temporal field far enough upwind to be able to tap the radiant power of the nova so that a field could be built big enough to hold a man.
Cooper sighed.
I wish they would get to the point where they stopped making me learn equations and field mechanics and start telling me some of the interesting stuff. Now, if I had lived in Melanson's time...
You would have learned nothing. He lived in the 24th, but eternity didn't start till late in the 27th. Inventing the field isn't the same as constructing eternity, you know, and the rest of the 24th didn't have the slightest inkling of what Melanson's invention signified.
He was ahead of his generation, then?
Very much so. He not only invented the temporal field, but he described the basic relationships that made eternity possible and predicted almost every aspect of it, except for the reality change. Quite closely, too. But I think we're pulling to a halt, Cooper. After you.
They stepped out.
Harlan had never seen senior computer Laban Twistle angry before. People always said that he was incapable of any emotion, that he was an unsold fixture of eternity to the point where he had forgotten the exact number of his Homewen century. People said that at an early age his heart had atrophied, and that a hand computer similar to the model he carried, always in his trouser pocket, had taken its place. Twistle did nothing to deny these rumors. In fact, most people guessed that he believed them himself. So even while Harlan bent before the force of the angry blast that struck him, he had room in his mind to be amazed at the fact that Twistle could display anger. He wondered if Twistle would be mortified in some calmer aftermath to realize that his hand-computer heart had betrayed him by exposing itself as only a poor thing of muscle and valves subject to the twists of emotion. Twistle said, in part, his old voice creaking,
"Father Time, boy, are you on the All-Wen Council? Do you give the orders around here? Do you tell me what to do, or do I tell you what to do? Are you making arrangements for all kettle trips now?"
He interrupted himself with occasional exclamations of,
"Answer me!"
then continued pouring more questions into the boiling, interrogative cauldron. He said finally,
"If you ever get above yourself this way again, I'll have you on plumbing repair and for good. Do you understand me?"
Harlan, pale with his own gathering embarrassment, said,
"I was never told that Cub Cooper was not to be taken on the kettle."
The explanation did not act as an emollient.
"What kind of excuse is a double negative, boy? You were never told not to get him drunk. You were never told not to shave him bald. You were never told not to skewer him with a fine-edged Tav curve. Father Time, boy, what were you told to do with him?"
"I was told to teach him primitive history."
"Then do so. Do nothing more than that."
Twistle dropped his cigarette and ground it savagely underfoot, as though it were the face of a lifelong enemy.
"I'd like to point out, computer," said Harlan, "that many centuries under the current reality somewhat resemble specific eras of primitive history in one or more respects. It had been my intention to take him out to those times, under careful spatio-temporal charting, of course, as a form of field trip."
"What? Listen, you chucklehead, don't you ever intend to ask my permission for anything? That's out. Just teach him primitive history. No field trips, no laboratory experiments either. Next you'll be changing reality just to show him how.
Harlan licked his dry lips with a dry tongue, muttered a resentful acquiescence, and eventually was allowed to leave. It took weeks for his hurt feelings to heal over somewhat. Chapter 4 Computer. Harlan had been 2 years a technician when he re-entered the 482nd for the first time since leaving with Twistle. He found it almost unrecognizable. It had not changed. He had. 2 years of technicianhood had meant a number of things. In one sense, it had increased his feeling of stability. He had no longer to learn a new language, get used to new styles of clothing and new ways of life with every new observation project. On the other hand, it had resulted in a withdrawal on his own part. He had almost forgotten now the camaraderie that united all the rest of the specialists in Eternity. Most of all, he had developed the feeling of the power of being a technician. He held the fate of millions in his fingertips, and if one must walk lonely because of it, one could also walk proudly. So he could stare coldly at the communications man behind the entry desk of the 482nd and announce himself in clipped syllables. Andrew Harlan, technician, reporting to Computer Finge for temporary assignment to the 482nd, disregarding the quick glance from the middle-aged man he faced. It was what some people called the technician glance, a quick, involuntary sidelong peek at the rose-red shoulder emblem of the technician. Then, an elaborate attempt not to look at it again. Harlan stared at the other's shoulder emblem. It was not the yellow of the computer, the green of the life plotter, the blue of the sociologist, or the white of the observer. It was not the specialist's solid color at all. It was simply a blue bar on white. The man was communications, a sub-branch of maintenance, not a specialist at all. And he gave the technician glance, too. Harlan said a little sadly, "Well?" Communication said quickly, "I'm ringing Computer Finch, sir." Harlan remembered the 482nd as solid and massive, but now it seemed almost squalid. Harlan had grown used to the glass and porcelain of the 575th, to its fetish of cleanliness. He had grown accustomed to a world of whiteness and clarity, broken by sparse patches of light pastel. The heavy plaster swirls of the 482nd, its splashy pigments, its areas of painted metal, were almost repulsive. Even Finge seemed different, less than life-size, somewhat. 2 years earlier, to Observer Harlan, Finge's every gesture had seemed sinister and powerful. Now, from the lofty and isolated heights of technicianhood, the man seemed pathetic and lost. Harlan watched him as he leafed through a sheaf of foils and got ready to look up, with the air of someone who is beginning to think he has made his visitor wait the duly required amount of time. Finge was from an energy-centered century in the 600s. Twistle had told him that, and it explained a good deal. Finge's flashes of ill temper could easily be the result of the natural insecurity of a heavy man used to the firmness of field forces and unhappy to be dealing with nothing more than flimsy matter. His tiptoeing walk, Harlan remembered Finge's cat-like tread well. Often he would look up from his desk, see Finge standing there staring at him. His approach, having been unheard, was no longer something sly and sneaking, but rather the fearful and reluctant tread of one who lives in the constant, if unconscious, fear that the flooring would break under his weight. Harlan thought, with a pleasant condescension, "The man is poorly adjusted to the section. Reassignment is probably the only thing that would help him." Finge said,
"Greetings, Technician Harlan."
"Greetings, Computer," said Harlan.
Finge said, "It seems that in the 2 years since..."
2 physio years, said Harlan. Finge looked up in surprise.
2 physio years, of course.
In eternity there was no time, as one ordinarily thought of time, in the universe outside. But men's bodies grew older, and that was the unavoidable measure of time, even in the absence of meaningful physical phenomena. Physiologically, time passed, and in a physio year within eternity, a man grew as much older as he would have in an ordinary year in time. Yet, even the most pedantic eternal remembered the distinction only rarely. It was too convenient to say, "See you tomorrow," or "I missed you yesterday," or "I will see you next week," as though there were a tomorrow, or a yesterday, or a last week in any but a physiological sense. And the instincts of humanity were catered to by having the activities of eternity tailored to an arbitrary 24 physio-hour day, with a solemn assumption of day and night, today and tomorrow. Finge said,
"In the 2 physio years since you left, a crisis has gradually gathered about the 482nd, a rather peculiar one, a delicate one, almost unprecedented. We need accurate observation now as we never have needed it before."
"And you want me to observe?"
"Yes. In a way, it's a waste of talent to ask a technician to do a job of observation, but your previous observations, for clarity and insight, were perfect. We need that again. Now I'll just sketch in a few details."
What those details were, Harlan was not to find out just then. Finge spoke, but the door opened, and Harlan did not hear him. He stared at the person who entered. It was not that Harlan had never seen a girl in eternity before. Never was too strong a word. Rarely, yes, but not never.
But a girl such as this, and in eternity.
Harlan had seen many women in his passages through time, but in time they were only objects to him, like walls and balls, barrows and harrows, kittens and mittens. They were facts to be observed. In eternity, a girl was a different matter, and one like this. She was dressed in the style of the upper classes of the 482nd, which meant transparent sheathing and not very much else above the waist, and flimsy, knee-length trousers below. The latter, while opaque enough, hinted delicately at gluteal curves. Her hair was glossily dark and shoulder-length, her lips redly penciled thin above and full below in an exaggerated pout. Her upper eyelids and her earlobes were tinted a pale rose, and the rest of her youthful, almost girlish face was a startlingly milky white. Jeweled pendants descended forward from mid-shoulder to tinkle, now this side, now that, of the graceful breasts to which they drew attention. She took her seat at a desk in the corner of Finge's office, lifting her eyelashes only once to sweep her dark glance across Harlan's face. When Harlan heard Finge's voice again, the computer was saying,
"You'll get all this in an official report, and meanwhile, you can have your old office and sleeping quarters."
Harlan found himself outside Finge's office without quite remembering the details of his leaving. Presumably, he had walked out. The emotion within him that was easiest to recognize was anger.
By time, Finge ought not to be allowed to do this.
It was bad for morale. It made a mockery. He stopped himself, unclenched his fist, unclamped his jaw.
"Let's see now."
His footsteps sounded sharply in his own ear as he strode firmly toward the communications man behind the desk. Communications looked up without quite meeting his eye and said cautiously,
"Yes, sir?"
Harlan said, "There's a woman at a desk in Computer Finch's office. Is she new here?" He had meant to ask it casually. He had meant to make it a bored, indifferent question. It rang out instead like a pair of cymbals clashing. But it roused communications. The look in his eye became something that made all men kin. It even embraced the technician, drew him in as a fellow. Communications said,
"You mean the babe? Wow. Isn't she built like a force field latrine, though?"
Harlan stammered a bit. "Just answer my question." Communications stared, and some of his steam evaporated. He said,
"She's new. She's a timer."
"What's her job?" A slow smile crept over Communications' face and grew into a leer.
"She's supposed to be the boss's secretary. Her name is Noyes Lambent."
"All right." Harlan turned on his heel and left. Harlan's first observation trip into the 482nd came the next day, but it lasted for 30 minutes only. It was obviously only an orientation trip, intended to get him into the feel of things. He entered it for an hour and a half the next day, and not at all on the third. He occupied his time in working his way through his original reports, relearning his own knowledge, brushing up on the language system of the time, accustoming himself to the local costumes again. One reality change had hit the 482nd, but it was very minor. A political clique that had been in was now out, but there seemed no change in the society otherwise. Without quite realizing it, he slipped into the habit of searching his old reports for information on the aristocracy. Surely, he had made observations. He had, but they were impersonal, from a distance. His data concerned them as a class, not as individuals. Of course, his spatio-temporal charts had never demanded or even permitted him to observe the aristocracy from within. What the reasons for that might have been was beyond the purview of an observer. He was impatient with himself at feeling curiosity concerning that now. During those 3 days, he had caught glimpses of the girl, Noyes Lambent, 4 times. At first, he had been aware only of her clothes and her ornaments. Now he noticed that she was 5'6" in height, half a head shorter than himself, yet slim enough and with a carriage erect and graceful enough to give an impression of height. She was older than she first seemed, approaching 30 perhaps, certainly over 25. She was quiet and reserved, smiled at him once when he passed her in the corridor, then lowered her eyes. Harlan drew aside to avoid touching her, then walked on feeling angry. By the close of the third day, Harlan was beginning to feel that his duty as an Eternal left him only one course of action. Doubtless, her position was a comfortable one for herself. Doubtless, Finge was within the letter of the law, yet Finge's indiscretion in the matter, his carelessness, certainly went against the spirit of the law, and something should be done about it. Harlan decided that, after all, there wasn't a man in Eternity he disliked quite as much as Finge. The excuses he had found for the man only a few days before vanished. On the morning of the 4th day, Harlan asked for and received permission to see Finge privately. He walked in with a determined step and, to his own surprise, made his point instantly. "Computer Finge, I suggest that Miss Lambent be returned to time." Finge's eyes narrowed. He nodded toward a chair, placed clasped hands under his soft, round chin, and showed some of his teeth. "Well, sit down, sit down. You find Miss Lambent incompetent? Unsuitable?" "As to her incompetence and unsuitability, computer, I cannot say. It depends on the uses to which she is put, and I have put her to none. But you must realize that she is bad for the morale of this section." Finge stared at him distantly, as though his computer's mind were weighing abstractions beyond the reach of an ordinary Eternal.
"In what way is she hurting morale, technician?"
"There is no real necessity for you to ask," said Harlan, his anger deepening. "Her costume is exhibitionistic. Her—"
"Wait, wait. Now wait a while, Harlan. You've been an observer in this era. You know her clothes are standard costume for the 482nd.
In her own surroundings, in her own cultural milieu, I would have no fault to find, though I'll say right now, that her costume is extreme even for the 482nd. You'll allow me to be the judge of that. Here in eternity, a person such as she is certainly out of place.
Finge nodded his head slowly. He actually seemed to be enjoying himself.
Harlan stiffened.
Finge said, "She is here for a deliberate purpose. She is performing an essential function. It is only temporary. Try to endure her meanwhile."
Harlan's jaw quivered. He had protested and was being fobbed off. To hell with caution. He would speak his mind. He said, "I can imagine what the woman's essential function is. To keep her so openly will not be allowed to pass." He turned, stiffly, walked to the door. Finge's voice stopped him.
"Technician," Finge said, "your relationship with Twistle may have given you a distorted notion about your own importance.
Correct that.
And meanwhile, tell me, technician, have you ever had a..."
He hesitated, seeming to pick among words.
"Girlfriend?"
With painstaking and insulting accuracy, back still turned, Harlan quoted, "In the interest of avoiding emotional entanglements with time, an eternal may not marry. In the interest of avoiding emotional entanglements with family, an eternal may not have children."
The computer said gravely,
"I didn't ask about marriage or children."
Harlan quoted further,
"Temporary liaisons may be made with timers only after application with the Central Charting Board of the All-Wen Council for an appropriate life plot of the timer concerned. Liaisons may be conducted thereafter only according to the requirements of specific spatio-temporal charting."
"Quite true. Have you ever applied for temporary liaison, technician?"
"No, computer."
"Do you intend to?"
"No, computer."
"Perhaps you ought to. It would give you a greater breadth of view. You would become less concerned about the details of a woman's costume, less disturbed about her possible personal relations with other Eternals."
Harlan left, speechless with rage. He found it almost impossible to perform his near-daily trek into the 482nd, the longest continuous period remaining something under 2 hours. He was upset, and he knew why.
Finge.
Finge and his coarse advice concerning liaisons with timers. Liaisons existed. Everyone knew that. Eternity had always been aware of the necessity for compromising with human appetites. To Harlan, the phrase carried a quivery repulsion. But the restrictions involved in choosing mistresses made the compromise anything but lax, anything but generous. And those who were lucky enough to qualify for such an arrangement were expected to be most discreet about it, out of common decency and consideration for the majority. Among the lower classes of Eternals, particularly among maintenance, there were always the rumors, half hopeful, half resentful, of women imported on a more or less permanent basis for the obvious reasons. Always, rumor pointed to the computers and life plotters as the benefiting groups. They, and only they, could decide which women could be abstracted from time without danger of significant reality change. Less sensational, and therefore less tongue-worthy, were the stories concerning the timer employees that every section engaged temporarily, when spatio-temporal analysis permitted, to perform the tedious tasks of cooking, cleaning, and heavy labor. But a timer, and such a timer, employed as secretary, could only mean that Finge was thumbing his nose at the ideals that made eternity what it was. Regardless of the facts of life to which the practical man of eternity made a perfunctory obeisance, it remained true that the ideal eternal was a dedicated man living for the mission he had to perform for the betterment of reality and the improvement of the sum of human happiness. Harlan liked to think that eternity was like the monasteries of primitive times. He dreamed that night that he spoke to Twistle about the matter, and that Twistle, the ideal eternal, shared his horror.
He dreamed of a broken Finge, stripped of rank. He dreamed of himself with the yellow computer's insignia, instituting a new regime in the 482nd, ordering Finge grandly to a new position in maintenance. Twistle sat next to him, smiling with admiration, as he drew up a new organizational chart, neat, orderly, consistent, and asked Noyes Lambent to distribute copies. But Noyes Lambent was nude, and Harlan woke up, trembling and ashamed. He met the girl in a corridor one day and stood aside, eyes averted, to let her pass. But she remained standing, looking at him, until he had to look up and meet her eyes. She was all color and life, and Harlan was conscious of a faint perfume about her. She said, "You're Technician Harlan, aren't you?" His impulse was to snub her, to force his way past, but, after all, he told himself, all this wasn't her fault. Besides, to move past her now would mean touching her. So he nodded briefly. "Yes."
"I'm told you're quite an expert on our time."
"I have been in it."
"I would love to talk to you about it someday."
"I am busy. I wouldn't have time."
"But, Mr. Harlan, surely you could find time someday."
She smiled at him.
Harlan said in a desperate whisper, "Will you pass, please? Or will you stand aside to let me pass? Please."
She moved by with a slow swing of her hips that brought blood tingling to his embarrassed cheeks. He was angry at her for embarrassing him, angry at himself for being embarrassed, and angry, most of all, for some obscure reason, at Finge. Finge called him in at the end of 2 weeks. On his desk was a sheet of perforated flimsy, the length and intricacy of which told Harlan at once that this concerned no half-hour excursion into time. Finge said,
"Would you sit down, Harlan, and scan this thing right now?"
"No, not by eye. Use the machine." Harlan lifted indifferent eyebrows and inserted the sheet carefully between the lips of the scanner on Finge's desk. Slowly, it passed into the intestines of the machine and, as it did so, the perforation pattern was translated into words that appeared on the cloudy white rectangle that was the visual attachment. Somewhere about midpoint, Harlan's hand shot out and disconnected the scanner. He yanked the flimsy out with a force that tore its tough cellulite structure. Finge said calmly,
"I have another copy."
But Harlan was holding the remnants between thumb and forefinger as though it might explode. "Computer Finge, there is some mistake. Surely I am not to be expected to use the home of this woman as base for a near week stay in time." The computer pursed his lips.
"Why not? If the spatio-temporal requirements are such. If there is a personal problem involved between yourself and Miss Lamp—"
"No personal problem at all," interposed Harlan hotly.
"Some kind of problem, certainly. In the circumstances, I will go as far as to explain certain aspects of the observational problem. This is not to be taken as a precedent, of course."
Harlan sat, motionless. He was thinking hard and fast. Ordinarily, professional pride would have forced Harlan to disdain explanation. An observer, or technician, for that matter, did his job without question, and ordinarily a computer would never dream of offering explanation. Here, however, was something unusual. Harlan had complained concerning the girl, the so-called secretary. Finge was afraid the complaint might go further. "The guilty fleeth when no man pursueth," thought Harlan with grim satisfaction, and tried to remember where he had read that phrase. Finge's strategy was obvious, therefore. By stationing Harlan in the woman's dwelling place, he would be ready to make counter-accusations if matters went far enough. Harlan's value as a witness against him would be destroyed. And, of course, he would have to have some specious explanation for placing Harlan in such a place, and this would be it. Harlan listened with barely hidden contempt.
Finge said, "As you know, the various centuries are aware of the existence of eternity. They know that we supervise intertemporal trade. They consider that to be our chief function, which is good. They have a dim knowledge that we are also here to prevent catastrophe from striking mankind. That is more a superstition than anything else, but it is more or less correct, and good, too. We supply the generations with a mass father image and a certain feeling of security. You see all that, don't you?"
Harlan thought, "Does the man think I'm still a cub?" But he nodded briefly. Finge went on.
"There are some things, however, they must not know. Prime among them, of course, is the manner in which we alter reality when necessary. The insecurity such knowledge would arouse would be most harmful. It is always necessary to breed out of reality any factors that might lead to such knowledge, and we have never been troubled with it. However, there are always other undesirable beliefs about eternity which spring up from time to time in one century or another. Usually the dangerous beliefs are those which concentrate particularly in the ruling classes of an era, the classes that have most contact with us and at the same time carry the important weight of what is called public opinion."
Finge paused as though he expected Harlan to offer some comment or ask some question. Harlan did neither. Finge continued.
"Ever since the reality change, 433 to 486, serial number F2, which took place about a physio year ago, there has been evidence of the bringing into reality of such an undesirable belief. I have come to certain conclusions about the nature of that belief and have presented them to the All-When Council. The Council is reluctant to accept them, since they depend upon the realization of an alternate in the computing pattern of an extremely low probability. Before acting on my recommendation, they insist on confirmation by direct observation. It's a most delicate job, which is why I recalled you, and why Computer Twistle allowed you to be recalled. Another thing I did was to locate a member of the current aristocracy who thought it would be thrilling or exciting to work in eternity. I placed her in this office and kept her under close observation to see if she were suitable for our purpose."
Harlan thought, "Close observation, yes." Again, his anger focused itself on Finge rather than upon the woman. Finge was still speaking.
"By all standards, she is suitable. We will now return her to her time. Using her dwelling as a base, you will be able to study the social life of her circle. Do you understand now the reason I had the girl here and the reason I want you in her house?"
Harlan said with an almost open irony, "I understand quite well, I assure you."
"Then you will accept this mission."
Harlan left with the fire of battle burning inside his chest. Finge was not going to outsmart him. He was not going to make a fool of him. Surely it was that fire of battle, the determination to outwit Finge, that caused him to experience an eagerness, almost an exhilaration, at the thought of this next excursion into the 482nd. Surely it was nothing else.
Chapter 5. Timer. Noyes Lambent's estate was fairly isolated, yet within easy reach of one of the larger cities of the century. Harlan knew that city well. He knew it better than any of its inhabitants could. In his exploratory observations into this reality, he had visited every quarter of the city and every decade within the purview of the section. He knew the city both in space and time. He could piece it together, view it as an organism, living and growing, with its catastrophes and recoveries, its gaieties and troubles. Now, he was in a given week of time in that city, in a moment of suspended animation of its slow life of steel and concrete. More than that, his preliminary explorations had centered themselves more and more closely about the Periesi,
The inhabitants, who were the most important of the city, yet who lived outside the city, in room and relative isolation. The 482nd was one of the many centuries in which wealth was unevenly distributed. The sociologists had an equation for the phenomenon, which Harlan had seen in print, but which he understood only vaguely. It worked itself out for any given century to three relationships, and for the 482nd, those relationships stood near the limits of what could be permitted. Sociologists shook their heads over it, and Harlan had heard one say at one time that any further deterioration with new reality changes would require the closest observation. Yet there was this to be said for unfavorable relationships in the wealth distribution equation. It meant the existence of a leisure class and the development of an attractive way of life which, at its best, encouraged culture and grace. As long as the other end of the scale was not too badly off, as long as the leisure classes did not entirely forget their responsibilities while enjoying their privileges, as long as their culture took no obviously unhealthy turn, there was always the tendency in eternity to forgive the departure from the ideal wealth distribution pattern and to search for other, less attractive maladjustments. Against his will, Harlan began to understand this. Ordinarily, his overnight stays in time involved hotels in the poorer sections, where a man might easily stay anonymous, where strangers were ignored, where one presence more or less was nothing, and therefore did not cause the fabric of reality to do more than tremble. When even that was unsafe, where there was a good chance that the trembling might pass the critical point and bring down a significant part of the card house of reality, it was not unusual to have to sleep under a particular hedge in the countryside. And it was usual to survey various hedges to see which would be least disturbed by farmers, tramps, even stray dogs during the night. But now Harlan, at the other end of the scale, slept in a bed with a surface of field-permeated matter, a peculiar welding of matter and energy that entered only the highest economic levels of this society. Throughout time, it was less common than pure matter, but more common than pure energy. In any case, it molded itself to his body as he lay down, firm when he lay still, yielding when he moved or turned. Reluctantly, he confessed the attraction of such things, and he accepted the wisdom which caused each section of eternity to live on the median scale of its century rather than at its most comfortable level. In that way, it could maintain contact with the problems and feel of the century without succumbing to too close an identification with a sociological extreme. It is easy, thought Harlan, that first evening, to live with aristocrats. And just before he fell asleep, he thought of Noyes. He dreamed he was on the All-Wen Council, fingers clasped austerely before him. He was looking down on a very small finge, listening in terror to the sentence that was casting him out of eternity to perpetual observation of one of the unknown centuries of the far, far up-Wen. The somber words of exile were coming from Harlan's own mouth, and immediately to his right sat Noyes Lambent. He hadn't noticed her at first, but his eyes kept sliding to his right, and his words faltered. Did no one else see her? The rest of the members of the council looked steadily forward, except for Twistle. He turned to smile at Harlan, looking through the girl as though she weren't there. Harlan wanted to order her away, but words were no longer coming out of his mouth. He tried to beat at the girl, but his arm moved sluggishly, and she did not move. Her flesh was cold. Finge was laughing, louder, louder. And it was Noyes Lambent laughing. Harlan opened his eyes to bright sunlight and stared at the girl in horror for a moment before he remembered where she was and where he was. She said, "You were moaning and beating the pillow. Were you having a bad dream?" Harlan did not answer. She said, "Your bath is ready. So are your clothes.
I've arranged to have you join the gathering tonight. It felt queer to step back into my ordinary life after being in Eternity so long. Harlan felt acutely disturbed at her easy flow of words. He said, "You didn't tell them who I was, I hope." "Of course not. Of course not." Finge would have taken care of that little matter by having her lightly psychoed under narcosis, if he felt that necessary. He might not have thought it necessary, however. After all, he had given her close observation. The thought annoyed him. He said, "I'd prefer to be left to myself as much as possible." She looked at him uncertainly a moment or two and left. Harlan went through the morning ritual of washing and dressing glumly. He had no great hopes of an exciting evening. He would have to say as little as possible, do as little as possible, be a part of the wall as much as possible. His true function was that of a pair of ears and pair of eyes. Connecting those senses with the final report was his mind, which, ideally, had no other function. Ordinarily, it did not disturb him that, as an observer, he did not know what he was looking for. An observer, he had been taught as a cub, must not have preconceived notions as to what data is desired or what conclusions are expected. The knowledge, it was said, would automatically distort his view, however conscientious he tried to be. But under the circumstances, ignorance was irritating. Harlan suspected strongly that there was nothing to look for, that he was playing Finge's game in some way. Between that and Noyes, he stared savagely at the image of himself cast in three-dimensional accuracy 2 feet in front of him by the reflector. The clinging garments of the 482nd, seamless and bright in coloring, made him, he thought, look ridiculous. Noyes Lambent came running to him just after he had finished a solitary breakfast brought to him by a Meccano. She said breathlessly, "It's June, Technician Harlan." He said harshly, "Do not use that title here. What if it is June?" "But it was February when I joined." She paused doubtfully. "That place, and that was only a month ago."
Harlan frowned. "What year is it now?"
"Oh, it's the right year."
"Are you sure?"
"I'm quite positive. Has there been a mistake?" She had a disturbing habit of standing quite close to him as they talked, and her slight lisp, a trait of the century rather than of herself personally, gave her the sound of a young and rather helpless child. Harlan was not fooled by that. He drew away.
"No mistake. You've been put here because it's more suitable. Actually, in time, you have been here all along."
"But how could I?" She looked more frightened still. "I don't remember anything about it. Are there two me's?"
Harlan was far more irritated than the cause warranted.
How could he explain to her the existence of micro-changes induced by every interference with time which could alter individual lives without appreciable effect on the century as a whole? Even Eternals sometimes forgot the difference between micro-changes, small c, and changes, large C, which significantly altered reality. He said, "Eternity knows what it's doing. Don't ask questions." He said it proudly, as though he himself were a senior computer and had personally decided that June was the proper moment in time and that the micro-change induced by skipping 3 months could not develop into a change. She said, "But then I've lost 3 months of my life." He sighed.
"Your movements through time have nothing to do with your physiological age."
"Well, have I or haven't I?"
"Have or haven't what?"
"Lost 3 months."
"By time, woman, I'm telling you as plainly as I can, you haven't lost any time out of your life. You can't lose any."
She stepped backward at his shout and then suddenly giggled. She said, "You have the funniest accent, especially when you get angry."
He frowned at her, retreating back. "What accent?" He spoke 50 millennial as well as anyone in the section, better probably. "Stupid girl."
He found himself back at the reflector, staring at his image, which stared back at him,
vertical furrows deep between its eyes. He smoothed them out and thought, I'm not handsome. My eyes are too small and my ears stick out and my chin is too big. He had never particularly thought about the matter before, but now it occurred to him, quite suddenly, that it would be pleasant to be handsome. Late at night, Harlan added his notes to the conversations he had gathered while it was all fresh in his mind. As always in such cases, he made use of a molecular recorder of 55th century manufacture. In shape, it was a featureless thin cylinder, about 4 inches long by half an inch in diameter. It was colored a deep but non-committal brown. It could be easily held in cuff, pocket, or lining, depending on the style of clothing, or, for that matter, suspended from belt, button, or wristband. However held, wherever kept, it had the capacity of recording some 20 million words on each of 3 molecular energy levels. With one end of the cylinder connected to a transliterator, resonating efficiently with Harlan's earpiece, and the other end connected field-wise to the small mic at his lips, Harlan could listen and speak simultaneously. Every sound made during the hours of the gathering repeated itself now in his ear, and as he listened, he spoke words that recorded themselves on a second level, coordinate with, but different from, the primary level on which the gathering had been recorded. On this second level, he described his own impressions, he ascribed significance, pointed out correlations. Eventually, when he made use of the molecular recorder to write a report, he would have not simply a sound-for-sound recording, but an annotated reconstruction. Noyes Lambent entered. She did not signal her entrance in any way. Annoyed, Harlan removed lip piece and earpiece, clipped them to the molecular recorder, placed the whole into its kit, and clasped that shut.
"Why do you act so angry with me?" asked Noyes.
Her arms and shoulders were bare, and her long legs shimmered in faintly luminescent fomite. He said, "I am not angry. I have no feeling for you at all." At the moment, he felt the statement to be rigidly true.
She said, "Are you still working? Surely you must be tired."
"I can't work if you are here," he replied peevishly.
"You are angry with me. You did not say a word to me all evening."
"I said as little as I could to anybody. I wasn't there to speak." He waited for her to leave.
But she said, "I brought you another drink. You seemed to enjoy one at the gathering, and one isn't enough, especially if you're going to be working."
He noticed the small Meccano behind her, gliding in on a smooth force field. He had eaten sparingly that evening, picking lightly at dishes concerning which he had reported in full in past observations, but which, except for fact-searching nibbles, he had thus far refrained from eating. Against his will, he had liked them. Against his will, he had enjoyed the foaming, light green, peppermint-flavored drink, not quite alcoholic, something else, rather, that was currently fashionable. It had not existed in the century 2 physio years earlier, prior to the latest reality change. He took the second drink from the Meccano with an austere nod of thanks to Noyes. Now why had a reality change which had had virtually no physical effect on the century brought a new drink into existence? Well, he wasn't a computer, so there was no use asking himself that question. Besides, even the most detailed possible computations could never eliminate all uncertainty, all random effects. If that weren't so, there would be no need for observers. They were alone together in the house, Noyes and himself. Meccanos were at the height of their popularity these 2 decades past, and would remain so for nearly a decade more in this reality, so there were no human servants about. Of course, with the female of the species as economically independent as the male, and able to attain motherhood if she so wished, without the necessities of physical childbearing, there could be nothing improper in their being together alone, in the eyes of the 482nd, at least. Yet Harlan felt compromised. The girl was stretched out on her elbow on a sofa opposite. Its patterned covering sank beneath her as though avid to embrace her. She had kicked off the transparent shoes she had been wearing, and her toes curled and uncurled within the flexible fomite, like the soft paws of a luxuriant cat. She shook her head, and whatever it was that had kept her hair arranged upward, away from her ears, in intricate intertwinings, was suddenly loosened. The hair tumbled about her neck, and her bare shoulders became more creamily lovely at the contrast with the black hair. She murmured, "How old are you?" That he certainly should not have answered. It was a personal question, and the answer was none of her business. What he should have said at that point, with polite firmness, was, "May I be left to my work?" Instead, what he heard himself saying was, "32 years." He meant physio years, of course. She said, "I'm younger than you. I'm 27, but I suppose I won't always look younger than you. I suppose you'll be like this when I'm an old woman. What made you decide to be 32? Can you change if you wish? Wouldn't you want to be younger?" "What are you talking about?" Harlan rubbed his forehead to clear his mind. She said softly, "You live forever. You're an eternal." Was it a question or a statement? He said, "You're mad. We grow old and die like anyone else." She said, "You can tell me." Her voice was low and cajoling. The 50 millennial language, which he had always thought harsh and unpleasant, seemed euphonious after all. Or was it merely that a full stomach and the scented air had dulled his ears? She said, "You can see all times, visit all places. I so wanted to work in eternity. I waited the longest time for them to let me. I thought maybe they'd make me an eternal, and then I found there were only men there. Some of them wouldn't even talk to me because I was a woman. You wouldn't talk to me." "We're all busy," mumbled Harlan, fighting to keep off something that could only be described as a numb content. "I was very busy." "But why aren't there more women eternals?" Harlan couldn't trust himself to speak. What could he say? That members of eternity were chosen with infinite care, since two conditions had to be met. First, they must be equipped for the job. Second, their withdrawal from time must have no deleterious effect upon reality. Reality. That was the word he must not mention under any circumstances. He felt the spinning sensation in his head grow stronger, and he closed his eyes for a moment to stop it. How many excellent prospects had been left untouched in time because their removal into eternity would have meant the non-birth of children, the non-death of women and men, non-marriage, non-happenings, non-circumstance that would have twisted reality in directions the All-When Council could not permit. Could he tell her any of this? Of course not. Could he tell her that women almost never qualified for eternity because, for some reason he did not understand, computers might, but he himself certainly did not, their abstraction from time was from 10 to 100 times as likely to distort reality as was the abstraction of a man? All the thoughts jumbled together in his head, lost and whirling, joined to one another in a free association that produced odd, almost grotesque, but not entirely unpleasant results. Noyes was closer to him now, smiling. He heard her voice like a drifting wind. "Oh, you eternals, you are so secretive. You won't share at all. Make me an eternal." Her voice was a sound now that didn't coalesce into separate words, just a delicately modulated sound that insinuated itself into his mind. He wanted, he longed, to tell her, "There's no fun in eternity, lady, we work. We work to plot out all the details of every when from the beginning of eternity to where Earth is empty, and we try to plot out all the infinite possibilities of all the might-have-beens and pick out a might-have-been that is better than what is and decide where in time we can make a tiny little change to twist the is to the might-be, and we have a new is and look for a new might-be forever and forever."
And that is how it has been since Vicar Melanson discovered the temporal field in the 24th, way back in the primitive 24th, and then it was possible to start eternity in the 27th.
The mysterious Melanson, whom no man knows and who started eternity, really, and the new might be forever and forever and forever and... He shook his head, but the whirligig of thought went on, in stranger and more jagged breaks and leaps, until it jumped into a sudden flash of illumination that persisted for a brilliant second, then died. That moment steadied him. He grasped for it, but it was gone.
The peppermint drink?
Noyes was still closer, her face not quite clear in his gaze. He could feel her hair against his cheek, the warm, light pressure of her breath. He ought to draw away, but strangely, he found he did not want to. If I were made an eternal, she breathed, almost in his ear, though the words were scarcely heard above the beating of his heart. Her lips were moist and parted. Wouldn't you like to? He did not know what she meant, but suddenly he didn't care. He seemed in flames. He put out his arms clumsily, gropingly. She did not resist, but melted and coalesced with him. It all happened dreamily, as though it were happening to someone else. It wasn't nearly as repulsive as he had always imagined it must be. It came as a shock to him, a revelation, that it wasn't repulsive at all. Even afterward, when she leaned against him with her eyes all soft and smiling a little, he found he had to reach out and stroke her damp hair with slow and trembling delight. She was entirely different in his eyes now. She was not a woman, not an individual at all. She was suddenly an aspect of himself. She was, in a strange and unexpected way, a part of himself. The spatio-temporal chart said nothing of this, yet Harlan felt no guilt. It was only the thought of Finge that aroused strong emotion in Harlan's breast, and that wasn't guilt, not at all. It was satisfaction, even triumph. In bed, Harlan could not sleep. The lightheadedness had worn off now, but there was still the unusual fact that for the first time in his adult life, a grown woman shared his bed. He could hear her soft breathing, and in the ultra-dim glow to which the internal light of the walls and ceiling had been reduced, he could see her body as the merest shadow next to his. He had only to move his hand to feel the warmth and softness of her flesh, and he dared not do that, lest he wake her out of whatever dreaming she might have. It was as though she were dreaming for the two of them, dreaming herself and himself and all that had happened, and as though her waking would drive it all from existence. It was a thought that seemed a piece of those other queer, unusual thoughts he had experienced just before. Those had been strange thoughts, coming to him at a moment between sense and nonsense. He tried to recapture them and could not. Yet suddenly, it was very important that he recapture them. For although he could not remember the details, he could remember that, for just an instant, he had understood something. He was not certain what that something was, but there had been the unearthly clarity of the half-asleep, when more than mortal eye and mind seems suddenly to come to life. His anxiety grew. Why couldn't he remember? So much had been in his grasp. For the moment, even the sleeping girl beside him receded into the hinterland of his thoughts. He thought, if I follow the thread, I was thinking of reality and eternity. Yes, and Melanson, and the cub. He stopped there. Why the cub? Why Cooper? He hadn't thought of him. But if he hadn't, then why should he think of Brinsley Sheridan Cooper now? He frowned. What was the truth that connected all this? What was it he was trying to find?
What made him so sure there was something to find? Harlan felt chilled, for with these questions a distant glow of that earlier illumination seemed to break upon the horizons of his mind, and he almost knew. He held his breath, did not press for it. Let it come. Let it come. And in the quiet of that night, a night already so uniquely significant in his life, an explanation and interpretation of events came to him that at any saner, more normal time, he would not have entertained for a moment. He let the thought bud and flower, let it grow until he could see it explain 100 odd points that otherwise simply remained odd. He would have to investigate this, check this, back in eternity. But in his heart, he was already convinced that he knew a terrible secret he was not meant to know. A secret that embraced all eternity. Chapter 6 Life Plotter. A month of physio time had passed since that night in the 482nd, when he grew acquainted with many things. Now, if one calculated by ordinary time, he was nearly 2,000 centuries in Noyes Lambent's future, attempting by a mixture of bribery and cajolery to learn what lay in store for her in a new reality. It was worse than unethical, but he was past caring. In the physio month just gone, he had, in his own eyes, become a criminal. There was no way of glossing over that fact. He would be no more a criminal by compounding his crime, and he had a great deal to gain by doing so. Now, as part of his felonious maneuvering, he made no effort to choose a milder phrase, he stood at the barrier before the 2456th. Entry into time was much more complicated than mere passage between eternity and the kettle shafts. In order to enter time, the coordinates fixing the desired region on Earth's surface had painstakingly to be adjusted, and the desired moment of time pinpointed within the century. Yet, despite inner tension, Harlan handled the controls with the ease and quick confidence of a man with much experience and a great talent. Harlan found himself in the engine room he had seen first on the viewing screen within eternity. At this physio moment, sociologist Voy would be sitting safely before that screen watching for the technician's touch that was to come. Harlan felt no hurry. The room would remain empty for the next 156 minutes. To be sure, the spatio-temporal chart allowed him only 110 minutes, leaving the remaining 46 as the customary 40% margin. Margin was there in case of necessity, but a technician was not expected to have to use it. A margin eater did not remain a specialist long. Harlan, however, expected to use no more than 2 minutes of the 110. Wearing his wrist-borne field generator so that he was surrounded by an aura of physio time, an effluvium, so to speak, of eternity, and therefore protected from any of the effects of reality change, he took one step toward the wall, lifted a small container from its position on a shelf, and placed it in a carefully adjusted spot on the shelf below. Having done that, he re-entered eternity in a way that seemed as prosaic to himself as passage through any door might be. Had there been a timer watching, it would have seemed to him that Harlan had simply disappeared. The small container stayed where he put it. It played no immediate role in world history. A man's hand, hours later, reached for it, but did not find it. A search revealed it half an hour later still, but in the interim, a force field had blanked out and a man's temper had been lost. A decision which would have remained unmade in the previous reality was now made in anger. A meeting did not take place. A man who would have died lived a year longer, under other circumstances. Another who would have lived died somewhat sooner. The ripples spread wider, reaching their maximum in the 2481st, which was 25 centuries upwind from the touch. The intensity of the reality change declined thereafter. Theorists pointed out that nowhere to the infinite upwind from the touch, the change had become too small to detect by the finest computing, and that was the practical limit. Of course, no human being in time could ever possibly be aware of any reality change having taken place. Mind changed as well as matter, and only eternals could stand outside it all and see the change.